coming out of my microphone is going to be 23 dB louder. That's 100 dB, that's 200 times louder. The peak energy of my speech, 23 dB higher, is 200 times louder than the average power of my speech. So now when you properly set up a broadcast transmitter and you want to make sure you don't overmodulate, do you set up the average or do you set up the peak, or do you use some kind of speech limiting circuit to try to control that? Okay, so if I'm trying to measure the average power of human speech and if I'm using a very fast responding voltmeter or power meter, it's jumping all over the place. And for me to try to set a red line across that screen and say there's the average power, boy, that's difficult. However, you speed that through the right kind of an integrator, because the peaks and the valleys of my speech probably takes place with periods of time in between of a quarter of a second. And if I've got an integrator that's got a time constant of, let me pick a number, 5 seconds, and I speak into it continuously for 30 seconds, and I'm getting an answer that's averaging, it's a moving average over 5 seconds, I now, with that integrator circuit, can with great accuracy tell you exactly what the average power of my
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
That integrator properly set up with the right time constants, I can give you the average power of my speech to 2 or 3 decimal places, even though on the screen it's jumping all over the place. So there's one case where an integrator is very handy. The second place where an integrator is very handy is both an operation of a automatic noise figure indicator or a radio telescope. Let me choose a radio telescope. Assume now that I want to measure the noise power, the radio noise power that's coming out of a particular star. I get this very high gain radio telescope. I first aim it at cold sky and I take a power reading. I then aim it at that star and I take another power reading. And what you're about to find out is pure random noise generated by Mother Nature is really very noisy. I know that sounds like it's repetitive words, but let me explain what I mean by that. If I took the noise with an extremely high quality radio telescope and I displayed it on a spectrum analyzer, for instance, and I want to know how much noise is coming out of the star at low frequencies, medium frequencies, and high frequencies. I'm displaying it on a spectrum analyzer, and if I set the spectrum analyzer with a 1 megacycle resolution bandwidth and a 1 megacycle video bandwidth on the spectrum analyzer, you do that on any well-operating spectrum analyzer you can put your hands on in a laboratory right now, even before you connect anything to the front panel, just looking at the internal broadband noise of the spectrum analyzer. You will see on that screen peaks and valleys. You'll see a band of noise, a chunk of grass across the bottom of the screen, where the top of the grass and the bottom of the grass is 10 decibels apart. In other words, the instantaneous noise power of broadband pure random noise generated by Mother Nature, let me drop, with a logarithmic display, will have 10 decibels of peak-to-valley ratio. And let's assume now that you're trying to measure the specific noise power out of that star to the nearest tenth of a dB or a hundredth of a dB, and that is a real requirement. You're looking for a tenth of a dB or a hundredth of a dB of accuracy of average noise power of that star today versus yesterday, because you're doing this kind of an experiment, you're doing that kind of an observation, and the noise on the screen is jumping up and down 10 decibels peak to valley continuously every microsecond. For you to get that kind of accuracy, and what the mathematicians will call this is the mu to sigma ratio. Mu means mean value, sigma means standard deviation. Real noise has a huge standard deviation, even though its mean value might be extremely well controlled. Okay. You are doing an integration process when you do the following with that spectrum analyzer. Set the resolution bandwidth, in other words, the IF bandwidth, as broad as it will go. 3 megacycles of bandwidth if your particular analyzer will do it. Well, let's assume that your particular analyzer, the broadest resolution bandwidth is 1 megacycle. Let me drop. 1 megacycle of IF bandwidth, resolution bandwidth is the way the knob is usually labeled. And then you set the video bandwidth to 10 hertz. What you're doing with that, 10 hertz means that every tenth of a second, your video is responding to the average noise power it saw during that tenth of a second. When you've got a 1 megacycle resolution bandwidth, that means 1 million events occurred during that second. But because you've got a 10 hertz video bandwidth, you're looking at 1/10 of a second of that. You're looking at 100,000 events. 1 million events per second because it's got 1 meg of bandwidth, but you're looking at 1/10 of a second worth of it. You're looking at 100,000 events. So when you set the spectrum analyzer that way, 1 meg res bandwidth, 10 hertz video bandwidth, you are integrating 100,000-to-1 bandwidth ratio. Every display, every dot on that screen, so to speak, coming out of that 10 hertz video amplifier being displayed on that screen of that spectrum analyzer, every dot on that screen represents the averaging of 100,000 events. Let me explain what that means. If I'm flipping a really fair coin, and I'm measuring how many heads and tails, if I flip the coin 3 times, I'm probably going to get 2 heads and 1 tail, 2 tails and 1 head. It's kind of hard to figure out what's going on. If I flip the coin 100,000 times, and I really did it correctly, you know darn well I would get very close to 50,000 heads and 50,000 tails, plus or minus a couple. It's called the central limit theorem of normal Gaussian distribution. It's a fancy mathematical term. When you take a whole lot of data and you properly average it, integrate it, you start finding out what's really happening. So if I take a lot of data, 100,000 flips, I'm going to get very close to 50,000 flips, plus or minus about 20, and 50,000 heads and 50,000 tails, if you know what I mean, on 100,000 events. I'm really integrating. Now, let me give you another example of this one. There was a very famous mathematics professor in a good college, I think it was at Stanford, let me drop, where he told his students, I want you to go home and I want you to flip a coin 1,000 times. I want you to record the number of heads and the number of tails. That's choice number one, the real experiment. But if you're kind of lazy, I'm going to give you an out. I'm going to allow you to make random numbers of heads and tails from your brain. I'm going to have you write down 1,000 things on the paper, heads and tails. So you can make the choice of really doing the experiment with a coin, or I'm going to call it the real coin flipping, or you can do the phony coin flipping. The choice is yours. He told that to the whole class. And the next day they came back with that homework assignment filled out. He walked up and down the aisles, and he looked at each one of those papers. And with extremely high accuracy, he knew immediately who did the real experiment and who did the phony experiment. And the students looked at each other and said, how the hell did he do that? Is he clairvoyant? Let me drop. And because the real experiment with 1,000 flips came very close to 500 heads and 500 tails. The guys who did the phony experiment came very close to 500 heads and 500 tails. In mean value, there was no difference. But the professor could tell immediately the phony data from the real data. The way he knew that is because he knew a secret about Mother Nature that the students didn't know. Mother Nature is really doing a random experiment. You wouldn't believe how random she is. Here's what happens. In the real experiment, really flipping heads and tails, when you do it 1,000 times, there's going to be a couple of times in that real data where there's 5 consecutive heads in a row, 6 heads in a row, or 7 heads in a row, or 7 or 8 tails in a row. Occasionally, Mother Nature will do that. Unless you're given a whole lot of information ahead of time, a human being doesn't know that. You're flipping tail, heads, and you're doing mental flips of heads and tails, and you think in order to make everything come out 50-50, heads and tails, you're not going to have a whole lot of consecutive heads and a whole lot of consecutive tails. Once in a while, you're going to have two, maybe three heads in a row. You doing it as a phony experiment. Mother Nature doesn't do that. Real random data has sometimes got some really funny glitches to it. It's very spiky data. And that's how he was looking at the standard deviation, so to speak, and he recognized the difference right away. So the fact that you're adding up 1,000 events in this coin flipping experiment and reporting the number of heads or a number of tails, you're really integrating a 1,000-to-1 ratio, so to speak. How many heads or how many tails of 1,000 experiments? There's a 1,000-to-1 integration factor taking place. That gives you a little bit of a feeling of just the integrator. It's a low-pass filter. I've now done it with...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I've now done it with... let me drop a little longer. I've now done it with the noise coming out of a star into your radio telescope, and it's very similar to what happens with an automatic noise figure indicator that's measuring the noise figure of your precision RF amplifier, or with coin flipping, or with human speech. So low-pass filtering at times allows you to get extreme results. In the case of the radio telescope, where they really want a big integration factor, there are a number of radio telescopes where the resolution bandwidth, the pre-detecting bandwidth, the IF bandwidth, same words, is sometimes 6,000 megacycles wide, 6 gigahertz wide, is the IF strip of the radio telescope. Then it goes into a rectifier, and it goes into a video filter, and the video filter might have a response of 1 hertz, or maybe 0.1 hertz. In that case, they're getting something in the vicinity of 5 billion to 1 integration factor. At first you would say, why in the world would they do that? Okay, I'm going to tell you why. The noise being generated by the precision RF amplifier on the front end of your radio telescope might have the equivalent noise power of a resistor at, let me pick a number, 100 degrees Kelvin. That's the noise power of the front end amplifier of your radio telescope. And you're looking at a star, which because the star is so far away and so small in the view of your radio telescope antenna, that it only gives you 1 degree Kelvin of change when you sweep from cold sky to that star. Can you resolve a signal of 1 degree Kelvin of star noise buried in the middle of your electronic noise of your radio telescope of 100 degrees Kelvin? In other words, this...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In other words, the signal you're looking for is 20 decibels, 100-to-1 weaker than the random noise of your electronics. That's a real state-of-the-art radio telescope that I'm describing to you. The signal is 20 dB below the noise, and the signal is random noise with all of its spikiness. So the star is putting out random spiky noise 100 times weaker than the noise of your precision electronics of your radio telescope. You're doing state-of-the-art work. At first, you and I would say, hey, that signal is way below the noise, no way in hell. Well, if I'm trying to get rapid demodulation of that amplitude or frequency modulated signal, you're absolutely right. But I'm doing low energy emitter search here. I'm doing real precision power measurement, power flux density measurement of that celestial source, that radio telescope looking at that star. Can I resolve 1 degree Kelvin out of 100 with the right integration factor? Easy as all hell. If I'm really using a Dickey switched receiver type radio telescope, I can do 1,000-to-1. The noise of the star I'm looking for could be 30 decibels weaker than the noise of my electronics, and with the right integration, it can be done. The Joe Taylor, WSJT, Weak Signal Joe Taylor, K2JT techniques that are being used with digital communication these days are doing that. By way of transmitting the right kind of tones with the right known effects ahead of time, a priori knowledge, with the right integration factors, the WSJT digital techniques that are doing weak signal detection, moon bounce among others, let me drop, those guys are regularly getting good, reliable data, 25 dB below the noise of the receiver, by the digital techniques. It's all integration. I haven't described differentiation yet. I've just described integration because that in itself is a huge factor when it comes to good metrology laboratory measurements with high accuracy. You've only heard 10% of the story, but hopefully it helps. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Great description, Dick. Very good. That's a lot of information for him to swallow, I'll say that. But he can go on with the research on that. But he's getting an idea of what's happening when you integrate. Okay. Carry on.
And I know we've only answered half of that question, and next week, Wendell, we'll go into the other half of it. You probably got at least one more question, John, that we should cover. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Dick, you want to handle the differentiating next week?
That's my recommendation. Do you have a second guy with a question? I don't think we should dwell for a whole half hour on one single question, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Let me let it drop. KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Got another Balan question. It seems like we gave some answers on Balans last week, and we have another question. Someone's getting very confused. And the question is, this is Joey from Connecticut. All right, his question is, how is it that the Balan only restricts RF energy in one direction? Why doesn't it work both ways? Why isn't there reciprocity in that attenuation that it does? Maybe you could describe the reflection coefficient and what actually happens at the Balan. Why does it pass in one direction and not the other? That's basically his question. Over to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I think I see what he's asking, John. And with the words you've given him, we've caused that question. We've caused that misunderstanding. In the case of coaxial cable being properly used, the signal is really flowing out of my transmitter into that coaxial cable in a very particular manner. All of the signal is between the center conductor, the outer surface of the center conductor wire of the coax cable, and the inner surface of the outer conductor. In other words, all the signal is contained inside of that coaxial cable, and there's no signal on the outside when that signal is being coupled to that cable by way of a good connector on the back end of that transmitter. The transmitter is well shielded. The shield of the coax cable is connected to that connector, therefore it's well shielded to the case of the transmitter, and all the signal is inside that cable. With all that signal inside that cable, the cable itself could be routed across the floor of my shack, through the hole in the wall, out to the backyard, down into the dirt of the backyard, into the mud of the backyard, and then it comes back up at the tower 50 feet away, which is my case, 70 feet away in my case. It comes back out of the ground, and then goes up the tower. That signal flowing down the center of the coaxial cable doesn't know that the outer chunk of cable, that the outside of the cable, the outer polyethylene jacket, was in contact with my wooden floor, the hole in the wall, the dirt and the mud outside, and the sheet metal and the steel of the tower. It doesn't know that. It's all contained inside the cable. If the antenna was a proper kind of antenna, where the antenna itself had a kind of a shield, just like the transmitter, if what I call antenna really is another black box at the top of the tower.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If the thing that I call antenna is a black box, a shielded metal black box at the top of the tower, which has another connector on the box, very similar to the connector on the outside of the on the back end of my transmitter. Now all the signal is contained inside the cable from beginning to end, and the signal is being delivered to that load inside that box. In the case of a well-designed feed horn, it comes pretty close to that. The signal gets launched inside the feed horn. The signal goes from an electronic signal on cable to a electromagnetic signal in the beginning of the waveguide of the horn, and then the signal comes roaring out the front end of the waveguide of the horn. A well-designed horn is a kind of a black box. Everything is shielded. No Balan is required anywhere. So signal flowing down the cable, no problem. If the horn in my example happened to have an improper impedance match. The horn has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Some of the signal delivered to the horn would be reflected back down. That's what 2-to-1 standing wave ratio means. 1/3 of the voltage that I deliver to the horn would be reflected back down. That's what a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is. 1 plus rho is the reflection voltage ratio. If rho is 1/3, and standing wave ratio is defined as 1 plus rho divided by 1 minus rho, 1 plus a third divided by 1 minus a third, I'm going to get 1 1/3 on top, I'm going to get 2/3 on the bottom, I do the division, and I get a 2-to-1. That's mathematically proving to you what a standing wave ratio is. Okay, so 1/3 of the voltage I deliver to that horn, in this example, because it's got a 2-to-1 visor, 1/3 of it gets reflected back down inside the cable. Thoroughly shielded. No problem. As long as my transmitter can tolerate a 2-to-1, no signal outside the cable in my horn example. That's the magic of a waveguide type horn. It acts like a black box.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
However, our dipole antenna is not like that. Our dipole antenna is a thoroughly symmetric radiating structure. There are people who think that the right-hand side of the dipole, the one connected to the center conductor, is the important one, and the left-hand side of the dipole, one connected to the shield, is the unimportant one. It's the counterpoise. Good way of thinking about it, dead wrong. Mother Nature is not like that. A dipole is a thoroughly symmetric antenna. If you were feeding it with twin lead, if it was a 70-ohm antenna and you're feeding it with 70-ohm twin lead, everything would be hunky-dory. However, how do you launch that signal into that twin lead down at the transmitter? An ordinary coax cable connector will not do that. It takes a fancy balun-like circuit to take the unbalanced signal coming out of your transmitter. They call it unbalanced because on the outside of the coax cable, there's no signal. In the inside of the coax cable, at the center conductor, there is a signal. Everybody calls that an unbalanced system. It's just a set of words telling you what it is. So that unbalanced system, you need a fancy transformer-like circuit at the transmitter to properly launch that signal into that twin lead. So if you were feeding the twin lead antenna, the antenna would be happy. No balun is required up there if I'm feeding it with two parallel wires, so to speak, like 300-ohm twin lead like we used to use on television sets. And there was a version of it made by the ITT company where the two wires are much closer together like zip cord, and it was a 72-ohm twin lead. Let me drop it. So feeding a real half-wave dipole with 72-ohm twin lead would work like a charm, but now you've got to work a little harder back at the transmitter to properly launch that signal in a thoroughly balanced differential manner. If at one instant of time, my weak signal going up that twin lead is +1 volt on the right-hand side of the twin lead, you must have exactly -1 volt on the left-hand side of the twin lead at that instant. And then as the other half of the sine wave comes, those two voltages reverse. But with reference to Mother Earth, those two voltages have to be thoroughly symmetric and opposite in polarity and equal in magnitude. That's a symmetric signal. That signal will have differential mode, no common mode. You could say that the coax cable has pure common mode signal from the center point of view. I won't go there. Because the dipole wants to act like a balanced load, Mother Nature makes that dipole, when it's radiating a signal, acts in a particular manner. Let me drop it. When you try to launch a signal onto a dipole, Mother Nature wants you to put +1 volt on the right side, -1 volt on the left side at that instant. They must be thoroughly symmetric and balanced and equal in magnitude. And on the next half cycle, it's the other polarity. You think with your coax cable you're going to do that by putting the center conductor to the right side and the shield to the second, to the left side. For the signal going up the cable, on the first pass, everything looks hunky-dory. But once that signal establishes itself on the dipole, and the majority of the signal does not just go on the dipole and jump into space, it's going to bounce back and forth on the dipole something like 20 times before it finally gets radiated into space. That's what resonance means. The signal is going to be bouncing back and forth a whole lot of times, and only a little bit of it is radiated on each bounce. And because the antenna might have a Q of 10 or 20, the current somewhere on that dipole is 10 or 20 times higher than the current that you launch from your cable, and the voltage is 10 or 20 times higher. That's the definition of Q. Bandwidth, voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, and a few other definitions. Because of the symmetric nature of the radiating characteristic and the reflections going on internally to that dipole, as simple as it looks, there's a hell of a lot more going on in there than first meets the eye. Let me drop. With your coax cable, you're trying to launch all the voltage from the center conductor on the right-hand side, and you think with the shield you're launching no signal on the left-hand side of the dipole. Mother Nature won't tolerate that. From her point of view, you think you've got a 72-ohm resistor antenna. Let me call it 70 ohms to round off the numbers. From her point of view, the right-hand side is a 35-ohm resistor to ground. The left-hand side is a 35-ohm resistor to ground. Between the left side and the right side, 35 plus 35 in series is 70 ohms. Each half of the dipole is a real impedance to what I'm going to call ground. And the word ground in this case has got a peculiar characteristic. I could be launching that signal on that dipole, and I'm a mile behind the space shuttle in free space. I'm 150 miles above Mother Earth, and you think you're far away from ground. Mother Nature says there is a real ground somewhere in this universe, and you're going to keep everything symmetric with reference to that ground. By the same token, I could have you, an astronaut, hanging out there in free space, and I could measure the capacitance between you and the rest of the universe. And it's going to be very close to 100 picofarad. You, as an electronic component, are a 100 picofarad capacitor. That's what happens when it comes to electronic discharge, and you're about to destroy some electronics that you're working on your bench, and you're not properly grounded. We're going to get into that in a minute. So, Mother Nature forces that symmetry. Therefore, because of the forcing of the balancing that she creates at the dipole, you're launching voltage on the right side, and you think you're not launching any on the left side. She is creating, in the dipole itself, voltage on the left side. And because the left side is connected to the dipole, the signal will now flow down the outside of the shield of the coax cable. You could, if you want to, let me drop. With the right kind of a circuit inside of a black box on the back end of your transmitter, you could, if you want to, launch a signal on the outside of your coax cable. And there are a number of circuits that do just that. If you go to the correct section on the antenna engineering handbook, which is called Balaning Devices, you'll see a number of places where you intentionally launch a signal on the outside of the coax cable, right at the transmitter. And everything obeys reciprocity. The signal's flowing up and down inside of the coax cable because of standing wave ratio. There's no preferential direction. The signal flowing up has a certain amount of loss. The signal flowing back down inside the cable has a certain amount of loss. Identical loss. You could, if you want to, launch a signal on the outside of the coax cable at the transmitter. Very few of us do that, but you could. And your dipole itself will launch a signal on the outside of the coax cable, feeding back down that cable, if you don't put what you and I would call an RF choke at that area. It's called a balun. You can make a poor man's balun by wrapping a few turns of the coax cable at that point and taping it, and taping it together. The signal flowing down the center of the cable that's inside of that few turns of coil, it doesn't know it's in a coil. Just like the coax cable going through the mud in my backyard doesn't know it's going through mud. It's all contained inside. But once it hits the dipole, and once the symmetry of the dipole takes place, current will flow back down. You think your dipole is the antenna. If you didn't put a balancing device there, your antenna consists of the right side of the dipole, the left side of the dipole, and the transmission line outer conductor, because you're feeding a signal back down. Therefore, you've got a very different antenna than you think you did. Maybe that helps a little bit. I know that the average person has to hear this jazz a number of times in a row before it sinks in and starts making some sense. At first, it defies common sense. For that matter, almost every antenna defies common sense, and maybe that's part of the explanation for why the average electrical engineering school, in my opinion, does an extremely poor job of teaching a new student how does an antenna operate and how do you design one. They do such a poor job, not intentionally. It's because the subject wasn't taught correctly to the professors in the first place. The blind is leading the blind. The professors don't feel comfortable with teaching antenna science, with rare exception. they in turn create students that don't feel comfortable with the subject. Very similar what happens to a number of Long Island schools where they don't have a good math teacher in the high school, and the principal goes up to the chemistry teacher and says, you're going to teach math this year. And he says, oh, hell, I want to be employed. All right, I'll put up with it. You sit in that class with that chemistry teacher who is forced to teach math, and you will probably end up hating that subject. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
Oh, there you're right, and a lot of people have been swayed away from certain topics because of teachers doing things that they really don't want to do. But that's very interesting, and, you know, slowly we're going to answer a lot of these questions that I don't think are fully explained when we talk about balance. So as the questions come in, we'll keep covering the balance if there's any more of them, and eventually we'll get a good general knowledge out there on actually how this thing functions and why it works. I never thought of this question that he would have. It's a joke. Well, why does it only work in one direction? But I think you covered it pretty well, Dick, and I'm sure he has a much better understanding now. So, okay, it's late. That'll be sufficient here. I know you wanted to speak about the topic that we were discussing, so maybe you want to do that. I don't think Paul has his space report. I didn't hear him say so.
Yeah, let me check with Paul. Paul, I know there was a little bit of a breakthrough this week where I think some carbon, so hydrocarbons, in other words, organic materials were discovered on Mars. I'm tempted to almost skip over the space report today because there's one other safety item I think is awful important that John and I have come across this week that I think we should cover. So give a couple minutes of space report if you think so, or if you think we should skip this week and it'll hold till next week. It's your choice, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW. Hey, maybe Paul's not there. One last call. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah, go ahead, Dick. WS2N.
Okay, yeah. Did you hear my previous five sentences about the space report, or should I repeat it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, unless there's something real good that you think won't wait until next week, I'm tempted to skip the space report tonight because there's a safety item that I think is more important that I'm going to go through with the little bit of time we got left on the space net, on the TechNet tonight. With your permission, I'll do that. It's over to you, Paul.
Will do. No problem. Very good, Dick. Go ahead. WS2X.
Yeah, this was a result of a conversation that John and I had earlier where we had a rush of brains to the head as to what's going on. There's a number of cases in life where you're told to do something, but you're not told why. And if you make the leap of faith and if the person is really telling you something that's accurate, that sort of works. But there's a lot of cases where you got to know why. The best example I can think of is my DX360, 3600 I guess it is, the Kodak old-fashioned digital camera we own. The instruction manual in about four places says, do not use alkaline batteries in there. The camera takes a pair of AA batteries, and you're allowed to use AA NiCad, AA carbon zinc batteries, but they say do not use a alkaline battery. And you're allowed to use a nickel metal hydride or nickel cadmium or the other kind. And why not? An alkaline battery's got plenty of capacity, it's got the right voltage. What's wrong? Nowhere in the manual do you tell you to do that. And I'm using alkaline batteries in that camera, and it works like a charm. My best guess as to what's going on is that when you buy the camera in a particular manner where you've got this docking device which allows you to download the pictures and to recharge the batteries, I think they don't want you trying to recharge an alkaline battery because it might explode. I think that's the reason, but they didn't tell you that. If they told me that, I would understand it because I own a device where I can unplug the little memory card out of the camera. I can plug it into this other device and download it into my computer. I'm not plugging it into the docking device, and I'm not doing any charging. So because of the way I use the camera, I seem to be getting away with using alkaline AA batteries in that camera. Okay, they didn't tell me the reason. We're all told...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
We're all told when you're in water, don't go near electricity. And we sort of accept that. Or conversely, if there's electricity anywhere near that water, don't go near that water. We sort of understand that. But the magnitude of that problem, you wouldn't believe. It's my belief a whole lot of people have recently died because of misunderstanding of this problem. The biggest thing you want to know about is, okay, how much conduction is taking place? How bad is seawater? You go and Google the words conductivity or resistivity of seawater. You read that chapter and you figure out what's going on. You suddenly say, wow, let me show you what's going on. The way you measure resistivities of fluid or solid materials, one part way of doing it is to start off with a known cube of the material. A cube of carbon would allow you to measure the resistivity of carbon or the conductivity of carbon or steel or seawater. You could start off with a fish tank that's made out of plexiglass, which is 1 cubic meter of plastic tank. And in order to measure the resistivity of seawater, you would put a sheet of metal on the left-hand side inside the water of the fish tank, and another sheet of metal on the right-hand surface. In other words, the two opposite walls of the 1-meter cube of fish tank made out of plastic, no metal anywhere, except for the sheet of metal you put on the left side and the sheet of metal on the right side, and you fill up this fish tank with 1 meter of water, 1 cubic meter of water, and now you put an ohmmeter between those two sheets of metal. You could ask a whole lot of your friends how many ohms you're going to measure. John made a guess 10 ohms. I guessed somewhere around 50 ohms. The answer is 0.2 ohms. Ordinary seawater, 1 cubic meter of it, has a resistivity of 0.2 ohms.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
By my standards, that's an extremely small number. And now let me show you where that's relevant. If you're doing the assembly of high quality, if you're doing assembly of high quality electronics anywhere in the last 20 or 30 years, and if you're doing it to mil spec, if you're doing it with doing it to code, so to speak, there will be a wrist strap on your left hand, so to speak. That wrist strap is going to ground your body. And normally the mat where you're doing the assembly on the bench is a black rubber mat with a sheet of metal inside of it, and the rubber is mildly conductive. So the mat is grounded, you are grounded, the bench is grounded, the whole thing is grounded to the ground of the building. Everything is grounded. Because if you have, for instance, a person scuffing his feet across the wool rug, or if you have a woman wearing nylon underwear and a Dacron dress, and you're getting the tribal electric effect of her clothing, a human being can easily develop, let me pick a number, 10,000 volts of electrostatic voltage on that human being with reference to ground. And a human being, as a capacitor, is 100 picofarad, plus or minus a little. You are 100 picofarad between your body and the rest of the universe. And you put 10,000 volts, 20,000 volts on that human being with that 100 picofarad, there's a significant number of joules of energy there. You walk over to that chunk of electronics with your finger and you touch one of the leads, or the arc takes place from the tip of your finger over to the lead of that chunk of electronics. You can either damage it on the spot or you can create what's called latent failure. That beautiful piece of electronics goes to the final testing department, works like a charm. A week later it suddenly fails because of that electrostatic discharge event, ESD event, that you created because you weren't grounded. So everybody doing that kind of assembly has that wrist strap grounding them. And I started thinking about that one day, and I said, wow. I mean, lots of people have encountered this guy, K2RIW, and said, boy, he's always sick in the worst-case situations. I said to myself, do you realize what would happen if that wrist strap is on the left hand of a woman who decides to
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If this woman doing assembly of electronics, she's got this wrist strap on her left hand, on her left wrist, grounding her. She decides to unplug the soldering iron. She reaches over to the plug of the soldering iron, starts pulling it out of the wall, and her finger happens to wrap around the front of the plug as it's being extracted, and her finger comes in contact with the hot blade, the so-called narrow blade, as it's being extracted from the wall. Her right-hand finger is now touching 120 volts AC, and her left side is grounded. Depending on the resistance of that contact, you put 60 cycle current through a human being, left hand to right hand, and you get in the vicinity of 60 milliamperes, there's a high probability you've just killed that person by electrocution. You're really going to send them into fibrillation. If somebody doesn't realize real fast what's going on and defibrillate that person, they're probably going to die. When it comes to AC current, 60 milliamps is definitely potentially lethal. Steady state DC current, it requires more like 200 or 300 milliamps. But AC current, only 60 milliamps is required. And so that grounding strap potentially is lethal. I started thinking about that one day and it scared the hell out of me. I decided to pick up that grounding strap and started investigating it. Let me drop. I measured the resistance of the wiring of that grounding strap. Between the part that contacts your body and the plug that goes into the grounding strip on that bench, you measure the resistance with an ohmmeter, and you measure something close to 1 million ohms. That's the safety. The 1 million ohms, with a human being charged with 10 kilovolts, and it's 100 picofarads of the universe, that 1 million ohms will discharge your body in something in the vicinity of a millisecond. So you are continuously being discharged. There's essentially no ability to build up that high voltage on your body because of the grounding strap with the 1 million ohms. With the 1 million ohms grounding your left hand wrist strap and your finger touches 120 volts, the worst that could flow in that situation if you had 0 ohms of contact resistance to that blade is 120 microamps. It takes 60 milliamps to be lethal. So the wrist strap that looked to me like a very lethal item, let me drop it. That wrist strap suddenly became very safe because of the 1 million ohm resistor in series with it. A hell of a lot of people would have been electrocuted if they hadn't done that. Somebody was smart enough to do that way back in year one, way back in the late 60s when they started doing electrostatic discharge protection with wrist straps, among other things. Okay, so if you're about to contact reasonable voltages that you've got in a home, 1 million ohms will protect you. And the voltages in your fuse panel are those reasonable voltages. But 1 cubic meter of water could potentially have a resistance, seawater, of 0.2 ohms. That's only 5 million times smaller. And if you're wading through that water, and that water is up to your waist, approximately 1 square meter of your body is in contact with seawater. Those two sheets of metal in that cubic, 1 cubic meter of seawater have 0.2 ohms. Each one of those sheets of metal is 1 square meter. And when you're walking through that seawater up to your waist, there's roughly 1 square meter of your body in contact with that seawater. By a number of techniques, we probably can measure from the bloodstream of your body through all of your skin and flesh and everything else, through that 1 square meter of your body that's in contact with the seawater, into the seawater, we could probably measure what is that contact resistance. I'm going to guess it's in the vicinity of 0.5 ohm. 1 million ohms will protect you, and you're contacted to that seawater with roughly 0.5 ohm. You come in contact with anything of over a couple of volts, you're potentially going to get into a lot of trouble. And even if your hands above the water don't touch anything, if now there is current flowing through that water, because somewhere in that basement of yours, water is touching the circuit panel or an applied...
Repeater, timeout, repeater.
So current is flowing through that seawater. There's a differential drop across the seawater. And your left leg versus your right leg has a certain spacing across that. It could potentially be lethal. And it isn't because you're near the source of the voltage. In other words, if the far end of your basement is touching the fuse panel and you're at the near end of the basement and you're 25 feet away from it, you might foolishly think you're safe. I wouldn't go there. The bottom line is, if there's electricity going to your house, or potentially somebody's going to turn on electricity in your house, and you think you're going to go into that seawater in your basement to recover Aunt Susie's pictures or whatever else you think is valuable, wow. There's a hell of a lot of people that appear to have drowned during this Hurricane Sandy event. It is my guess that a high percentage of those people were electrocuted. Because we're not taking the time to do a really proper autopsy on all those people, we don't know that. And to try to differentiate between an electrocution that once the current starts flowing through your body and your muscles stop being controlled by that current and your brain can't control them anymore, and you can't walk out of that seawater again, and you eventually end up sinking in it and drinking the seawater, and yeah, it looks like you drowned, but the initiating event could very well be electrocution. Sort of like talking about a person who died. Why did he die? Well, cardiac arrest. Well, everybody who dies no longer has heartbeat. There's a hell of a lot of other things that can go on here. So I think a significant percentage of those people didn't understand this principle. They thought they were recovering their valuables from a basement. The electricity was still on, and they went down there to recover it, and I think they became electrocuted. That's a strong belief. We'll eventually find out someday. I'm now giving you some of the reasons why I strongly believe you do not put your body in water if there's any electrical appliance anywhere within some ridiculous distance, if you know what I mean.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm going to give you one other example, and that is, if we now had the ability to plot equipotential voltages across that seawater in your basement that's touching the circuit panel at one end of the basement, and you're going to have a whole bunch of circles of equipotential closely spaced near the circuit panel, and as you get further and further from the circuit panel, those equipotential circles will spread out to be a greater and greater distance. That's the volts per meter of differential voltage across that seawater. So as you get far enough from the circuit panel, you think you're safe. There is a slim possibility that you've got a very well insulated basement. It's got extremely good waterproofing. So the water doesn't flow from the outside walls to the inside walls. Your basement could be very well insulated, but at the far end of the basement, there's a water pipe going to the outside world that's grounded. There's some possibility that the whole darn basement becomes hot with voltage, 120 volts, so to speak, but near the grounding water pipe at the other end of the basement, that's where the majority of the current is flowing to, and now you get a whole lot of close circles of equipotential around that grounded pipe at the far end of the basement. There's a slim possibility you're at the far end of the basement near a grounded water pipe and you think you're safe. It could be the extreme opposite. Don't go in water when there's voltage anywhere nearby. Now you know a little bit of why I think that's so darn important, why I think it's so darn lethal. You guys probably have some opinions on all of this. Give me your opinions right now. Give me your call letters and name, KQRIW on the TechNet.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. Anyone else? Go right ahead, Paul.
Comment.
Okay, I was thinking about experimenting with this, but it seemed kind of dangerous. So I was wondering what would happen if you took like a 10-foot piece of garden hose, filled it up with salt water, and connected, let's say, a hot end to one end, and a light bulb to the other end, and then a neutral end to the other end of the light bulb. You know, just make a complete AC circuit out of this with 120 volts. I wonder if that light bulb would light up, Dick.
Because the way resistivity is defined, ohms equals R L over A, rho L over A. The number of ohms you're going to measure is a product of the resistivity of the material, that's the rho, the length of the material, that's the L, the area of the material, that's the A. So resistance in ohms equals R times L over A. So because you know the area of the contact that you're establishing at each end of the hose, you know the area at each end, and know the length of the hose, and you know the resistivity of seawater, it is 0.2 ohm meter. That's the units of resistivity. Ohm dot meter. So you plug 0.2 into that equation, where you know the area and you know the length, you can predict with high accuracy exactly how many ohms is that seawater going to be in that water, in that garden hose. Therefore, you can calculate by that series resistor and the 120 volts applied, you can calculate whether or not the light bulb is going to light, how much current is going to flow through the light bulb. And therefore, you can even calculate whether or not it will work with a long hose or a short hose. But you can see the mathematics on that one, Paul. And if you go to the Google Wikipedia, you simply Google the word seawater resistivity. And you go to that right Google site, you'll see that exact layout of that thing I just described to you. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. I thought of that because, you know, what you were talking about last week, basically similar description about walking through the water. And I figured, well, there had to be a path, you know, there was, if there's a path, a hot and neutral, you know, and you're in between it, you know, I mean, what kind of a charge is going to go through your body? And I figured, well, if you could light up a light bulb with a hose, you know, that would tell you the story, you know, if you got in between that, you and that light bulb and the hose, you know, it would be all over, I would think. Back to you, Dick.
You got to be careful, though, Paul. With the experiment you just described, you could get a false alarm. By that, I mean a misdetection is a better way of putting it. Because the way you're making contact with the seawater at one end of the hose is probably only a couple of square inches of contact, maybe only one square inch of metal coming in contact with one end of the hose, and only one square inch of metal coming in contact with the seawater at the other end of the hose. So there you've got very little area and a very long length. Your particular hose experiment is going to be a fairly big resistor, and it might not light up the light bulb. But when your body is in a solid chunk of seawater in your basement that is waist high, and the whole bottom half of your body up to your waist is in contact with that seawater, 1 square meter of your flesh is touching that seawater. The real resistance between you and that seawater is something in the vicinity of 0.5 ohm. Whereas in your hose experiment, you may measure a resistance of 100 ohms. Your hose has got a small area on the ends and a long length. That seawater is a volumetric resistive material, and you are really in solid contact with it. Let me tell you something else about a human being. Let me drop. You can easily get a false impression with you, with your two fingers, your fingers in your left hand, index finger and thumb, you grab one lead of your ohm meter, and your index finger and thumb on the right hand, you grab the other lead of your ohm meter, and you now watch the number of ohms registered on your ohm meter. And you'll come up with a pretty high number. There's a problem. The total amount of area of that left probe touching your fingers is probably not even 1 square centimeter. On top of that, skin has a very peculiar resistance. You read the right section of Wikipedia on electrostatic discharge. As the voltage gets high enough, the dielectric strength of human flesh changes. In other words, if I'm putting a probe on my finger, I'm putting a probe on the index finger of your left hand, I'm putting another voltage probe on the index finger of your right hand, and I'm putting some voltage between the two, and I'm measuring how much current that flows. That's the way an ohm meter works, by the way. And I'm measuring ohms. And I start raising the voltage. The number of ohms at higher voltage goes down. There's a breakdown characteristic of the way your skin behaves. On top of that, when there's more and more area of your skin being exposed to the voltage, like it will be in seawater, large amounts of area of your skin are in contact with that seawater. Let me drop. All of a sudden, there's a zillion individual paths between that skin and the blood supply. Your blood is like wiring radio-wise, electronically. As far as electric wiring is concerned, your blood is a highly conductive saline solution. If there's enough area of your hand in contact with the seawater, and there's enough parallel paths, a zillion paths, between all of that skin and all of those blood vessels in your hand, and all of a sudden the blood vessels, the arteries and vein of your left hand and your left arm are now lit up with the voltage in contact with that right hand, and you do the same thing in the left hand, and that wiring that you and I call arteries and veins flows up your arm, through your chest, through the heart, back down the other arm and other hand. Do you see the wiring of that circuit? If you've got enough parallel paths going to those arteries and veins and capillaries of your hand, all of a sudden you've got very low resistance into very low resistance wiring that you and I call blood supply. And you supply that current to the heart, and you're probably in a lot of trouble. WS2N, K2LIW.
Oh, I can see that now. If you took, 100 of these hoses and 100, you know, times the amount of metal on each end and then attached your body to, you know, you got in between these hoses, you know, 100 of them, you know, you're definitely going to change the the ohm reading, you know, one hose, it'll be, you know, 100 hoses. So the ohms are really going to drop. So I can see that. But then you come across the idea of, you ever see the show where the guy is working around the high power lines and he puts the metal suit on. I mean, it's a woven metal suit. It surrounds the guy, and he gets out of the helicopter, and he climbs onto this thing. He's got this long pole, and he creates an arc to this 250,000-volt line, and he's able to, like, work on this thing. Put a platform up there and work on it. No problem, because the electricity's gone through this metal around them. You would think that would be also the case in the water. If the water's resistance is lower than your body, it's kind of like going to go around you, Dick, wouldn't it? Back to you.
Good guess. No way, Paul. Yes, that water around you is conductive, and it tries to make an equipotential across your body. However, if the fuse panel at one end of the basement is in contact with the 120-240 volts, and a short distance away, something is grounded like a water pipe, and now the current is flowing between the two, and in the seawater, the 120 volts across, let me pick a number, 10 meters, is going to give you 120 divided by 10, 12 volts per meter of E-field in that seawater, and now 12 volts per meter flowing from your left leg to your right leg, assuming your left leg is closer to the fuse panel and your right leg is closer to the water pipe, I think you can see what can happen. If I put two very good conducting probes between your left temple of your head and your right temple of your head, 10 volts is lethal. Here we can get 10 volts per meter, and the separation between your two legs might be 1 meter, and you could get that 10 volts. And the current flowing up the blood supply of your left leg going to the heart and back down to the right leg completes the circuit, if you know what I mean. And by the way, I said 10 meters away is the ground. That's 30 feet. It ain't going to be 30 feet. The nearest ground is going to be a much smaller distance. The volts and volts per meter across that seawater is going to be a much bigger number. Yeah, don't want to play with this stuff, Paul. And by the way, you and I now have the mathematics. Let me drop.
Well, I used the 10-foot hose, Dick. I figured it had to be 10 foot, not 20 or 30.
I hear you. But you've got to look very differently at all the stuff in your basement, because some of those people, the water came up to the ceiling of the basement, and people thought they're going to go down there, hold their breath, and capture that valuable item and go back. Oh, my goodness. A fair number of those people did not survive, in my opinion. You don't want to play with this stuff. Because the conductivity between that seawater and you is so extremely high, and because there can be differential voltages across the seawater, or you're in the seawater and you touch something else, the whole down body of seawater that you're in may be 30 volts away from ground, and in the process of you walking yourself across, with your hands you're touching the rafters of the ceiling, and you try to walk yourself across the basement, so to speak, and you happen to touch a water pipe. And you say, hey, the seawater is grounded, and I'm grounded, and I'm touching a grounded water pipe. You don't want to do that. You don't want to play with the stuff, Chad. You can now see why Con Ed and LIPA will not establish electrical contact, electrical power, back to a damaged house until they've inspected all the wiring of that house. They know where the water is. They know how much wiring has been replaced. In the case of Romex cabling, which has a kind of a paper insulation inside, really all has to be replaced. A hell of a lot of electrical circuits and a lot of houses have to be replaced before you're up to code, before Con Ed or LIPA is allowed to re-electrify your house. A lot of people are unhappy that they haven't yet been electrified. There's some darn good reasons why they haven't been. K2LIW listening. Now, we've only got about a minute and a half less. What you guys heard is that's the good news of TechNet number 4127 of the series that began back in 1982. John and I will be back next week covering more of this jazz. You've heard an awful lot of opinions. Not every bit of it is 100% accurate, but by way of the website that records all this, we get a kind of peer review, so to speak. People will read those emails, and they'll read those recordings. They'll listen to those recordings on the website and say, hey, I disagree with you for such and such.